Chapter 14. A Town Called Despair. Aisha Shieldborn cursed and ducked away from the groping hands of the vine-snared corpse. Splintered nails clattered against the face of his shield, a stinging fly spewed from the sagging jaws. He bashed the hanging body aside and crushed its skull, blocking the torrent of insects. Immediately, he was beset by another. There were too many corpses to avoid, and possibly more than even he could handle. The enormous, cracked archway above was thick with a shroud of yellowing vines. The innumerable corpses trapped within them had twitched into motion the moment the cobalt-limbed galley had swept beneath them. The flickering starlight that danced along the rails and mast kept most of the dead at bay, but even so, there were simply too many of them. Bodies flopped and fell to the deck, smothering the azure radiance long enough for more of the dangling corpses to descend and attack. Dead hands groped and battered at unwary warriors, as bodies descended towards the ship like twisted spiders. More and more of them, with every passing moment, attacking the stormcasts on the deck and those rowing as well. The galley shuddered with their weight. The decks were a riot of struggling forms as stormcasts fought back to back against the deluge of leprous corpses.
"This is intolerable,"
Aisha said, glaring up at the clutching canopy of hands and teeth that groped for him.
"I shall pass along your complaints to the Steel Soul," Solas said, sheltering beneath another Liberator's raised shield.
The Judicator Prime loosed a scintillating arrow and nodded in satisfaction as it thumped into a corpse's skull, rendering it limp. Aisha's ignored Solas and concentrated on the task at hand.
"Burkut, keep that shield up,"
he growled, jostling one of his warriors.
"Serena, Thomas, brace and step, make us some room. Taya, stop playing with that thing and get back into position."
He moved to help the warrior as she struggled with a particularly stubborn corpse. The diseased carcass clung to her shield with fierce tenacity, its crushed jaw flopping against her war mask. Aisha scraped the thing away and trod on its head, pulping it. Taya nodded her thanks.
"These things smell worse than aurochs," she said, coughing.
"Then breathe through your mouth," Aisha said gruffly.
He spotted garters fighting at the prow, where the dead were thickest. Talon fought at his side, savaging corpses with his beak and claws. The Lord Celestin blazed with an elemental radiance as he struck down corpse after corpse. Truly a sign of Sigmar's favor. Tearing his gaze from the Lord Celestin, he slammed his shield into a corpse as it swung itself towards him and smashed its crumbling face out of the back of its skull. A blow from his hammer caught another in the spine and dropped it to the deck. Everywhere he looked, there were vines and bodies wriggling through them. They needed to clear this place, to purify it all at once. Even as the thought occurred to him, he caught sight of Pharos and his retributors swatting corpses from the air. Aisha glanced at Solas.
"Solas!" he called.
Solas nodded, understanding instantly. He signalled, and nearby Judicators switched their aim, covering Aisha's and his retinue as they pushed towards the retributors.
"Heavy hand! Remember the seeping fen?"
Aisha shouted, shouldering aside an arrow-studded corpse. Pharos glanced at him in evident confusion. Then his eyes brightened with realization. He laughed, loud and long.
"Brothers and sisters, let us play our war song!"
Pharos rumbled.
"If the dead wish to dance, we will give them reason to do so."
Retributors turned towards one another, ignoring the enemies that crowded about them. Aisha's liberators moved to surround them, warding the paladins with their shields and hammers. Pharos and his retinue began to chant, slowly and sonorously, as they clashed their hammers together rhythmically. Fat sparks of crackling sky magic danced with every contact. The crash of hammers grew louder and quicker. More lightning leapt up, dancing from hammer to hammer. Aisha resolutely looked away from the burgeoning glow. To stare at it too long was to risk blinding oneself. Behind him, Pharos's voice rose in a paean to Sigmar's glory. Despite himself, Aisha began to sing along. Sparks leapt up and flittered across the plates of his armor and the runes of his hammer. And then, With one final, echoing clash of hammers, a gout of celestial lightning snarled upwards through the vines. Fire blossomed on the rotting vegetation and raced from vine to vine. Twitching corpses were consumed, reduced to ash and blackened bone in moments. Aetius raised his shield and swatted aside a burning cadaver, pleased. They'd used the trick before, to cleanse the air of miasma at the seeping fen and burn away the thick swarms of flies that had sought to blind them. A rumbling groan of displeasure drowned out the final verse of the war hymn and punctured Aetius's self-satisfaction. He looked up and saw the two monstrous statues crouching to either side of the archway turn slowly, inexorably, towards the galley. The great unclean one twisted on its plinth, sword rising, as if to chop through the vessel. The eyes of the statue blazed with hideous life, and its face cracked and crumbled as it twisted with gloating malice. Before it could strike, a whirling barrage of hammers slammed into its blubbery features, further cracking them. Tegras and his prosecutors had been, until now, grounded by the canopy of vines. Now they had taken advantage of the canopy's incineration and hurtled skyward to bombard the threatening statue. But even as the great unclean one rocked on its plinth, its companion undulated towards the flying stormcasts, avian beak wide. The stony lord of change vomited a coruscating bolt of eldritch flame. One of the prosecutors, half a second too slow, fell twitching to the deck, his armour warping and bulging in an obscene transformation. Stormcast scattered as the warrior crashed down. The prosecutor screamed in agony as his own armour consumed him, using his skin and muscle to build itself a glistening, fleshy shell. Tendrils crafted from ligament lashed at any who drew too close, and a stinger made from a splintered spinal column emerged from the heaving mass.
"Sigma preservers!" Aetius hissed.
The newborn chaos spawn clattered towards the closest group of stormcasts, claws of twisted sigmarite clacking. He glanced at Pheros. The Retributor Prime nodded.
"Lead the way, Shieldborn! My hammer is at your back!"
They advanced on the creature. It spun towards them, eyeball-topped cilia sprouting from the stretched mouthpiece of a bent helmet. Something rattled, and it scuttled towards them, snapping its claws. A volley of gleaming arrows peppered its flank, drawing its attention towards Solus and his judicators. Aetius gave a silent prayer of thanks for his friend's quick thinking. He closed with the creature, absorbing a blow from its stinger tail on his shield. Swiftly, he smashed the tail to flinders. He dodged back as the monster whirled towards him, claws snapping.
"Pheros! Put it out of its misery!"
"Only the faithful!"
Pheros roared as his lightning hammer slammed down against its fleshy shell. The spawn was momentarily flattened by the force of the blow, and Pheros finished it off before it could recover. He pinned it in place with his foot and brought his hammer down again and again until the creature was a broken ruin. Pheros stepped back.
"Sleep now, brother, that your soul might rise again with storms yet to come," he said. "Sleep the sleep of the faithful."
Aetius heard a monstrous shriek and saw that they'd left the statues behind. Both had endured the attention of the prosecutors, and clouds of smoke and dust rose from them. But already they were repairing themselves. Cracks closed. Debris rolled back up the hunched forms, seeking familiar divots.
"Sigma's bones! We're going to have to fight them again, aren't we?" he said in frustration. "Your confidence is encouraging," Lord Relictor Morbus said as he strode between Aetius and Pheros.
He sank to one knee beside the steaming remains of the chaos spawn. Aetius looked at him, confused.
"My what? To fight them again implies that we will survive to return this way," Morbus said, as he waved a hand over the broken thing.
He made a grasping gesture and murmured softly. Sparks of light rose from the ruin of meat and bone and danced briefly across his fist before sinking into his hand. Morbus sagged as if a great weight pressed down upon him. He rose and glanced at Aetius.
"That was quick thinking earlier."
Aetius shrugged.
"It needed doing." Morbus chuckled.
So it did.
He staggered, and Ferros caught him.
Are you injured, Lord Relictor? No, merely tired.
Morbus pushed himself away from the Retributor Prime.
But then, so are we all.
He leaned against his staff.
Though our bodies are fatigued, we yet advance. Thus are the faithful known. Only the faithful, Aisha said, solemnly.
The deck shuddered. Waves smacked at the sides of the galley as it travelled down an overflowing runnel of moss-covered stone. The walls of the aqueduct rose high over the galley, and its rim was encrusted with tumorous malformations that might have been ramparts and towers. Strange, pale faces peered out of gaping holes, watching as the galley passed by. The fungoid features retreated as the light washed over them. Aetius watched them warily.
This place is full of horrors. This is only the first level, Morbus said. There are six more, according to our captive.
Aetius glanced towards the mast, where the Rotbringer sat chained. Thus far, the Pox Knight had given them no cause to pitch him over the side, but Aetius itched to do so, regardless. As if reading his thoughts, Morbus said,
He has been truthful so far.
It will not last.
And why should he lie?
Solas asked as he joined them. His armor was streaked with ash and gore, but he seemed unharmed. Aetius was glad of that, though he'd never admit it. Solas was the closest thing he had to a friend.
He is a thing of chaos, Aetius said.
Solas nodded in agreement.
Fair enough.
He studied the Rotbringer.
Still, one can't help but wonder. One can, if one tries, Aetius said.
Solas dropped a companionable fist on his shoulder plate.
Forgive me, brother. I sometimes forget who I'm talking to.
Aetius couldn't decide whether to be insulted or not, so he remained silent. In any event, it was soon too noisy to speak. The roaring of the waters had grown deafening, and it was all they could do to hold on. The galley rose and fell, seemingly at random. Past the edges of the aqueduct, Aetius could see more lengthy runnels, all slanting downwards along a cliff face at wrong angles from their own monstrous gateways. Water roared between them in an unceasing torrent, tumbling into the depths. This shroud of water was only broken by a series of steep, winding paths, which cut through the thick fungal foliage clinging to the inner curve of the cliffs. No, not cliffs. The inner rim of the great tiers that made up this place. Carved by some gargantuan stonemason in time out of mind, at the behest of a demon god. Everything about this realm spoke of filth and degradation. It stained one's mind as well as one's armor. Despite Morbus's protective incantations and the prayers they murmured almost constantly, a fell aura surrounded the stormcasts. It was like a piece of grit caught between armor and flesh, all but unnoticed at first, but growing ever more uncomfortable and distracting. It was a constant battle to keep their armor scraped free of mold, made worse by the spores that floated through the damp air. The deck shifted beneath him, timbers groaning. The angle of the aqueduct was leveling off as they neared the bottom. Water filled a swirling bay, surrounded on all sides by jagged rocks and thick bold trees, the branches of which dipped into the waters. Flocks of things that might have been birds or bats glided through the air, their shrill cries soaring over Aetius's nerves. Moisture pattered across the deck from above. It turned to steam as it reached the blue radiance flickering from the rails and mast.
That grinding sound is going to get on my nerves quickly, Ferros said.
Aetius was about to ask him what he was talking about when he heard it. Like two massive stones scraping away at one another.
What is that? This place is in constant motion, Morbus said. The tiers turn at the whim of their maker, spinning slowly but inexorably in place.
Like one millstone set upon the next, Solas said.
Aetius looked at him.
What?
This place, it's like a stack of millstones.
How would you know what millstones look like?
Solas shrugged. I was a miller. Pharos turned.
You were a what?
The retributor sounded aghast.
A miller. I worked in a mill, grinding corn.
Solas looked at them.
What?
Pharos and Aetius exchanged a glance.
Nothing, Aetius said. It's just...
He shook his head.
Never mind.
It was a reminder that heroism was more a matter of moment than birth. While many Stormcasts had been warriors in their previous lives, some had been farmers, merchants, even beggars. Faith and a moment of courage had earned them their place in the Hallowed Knights. A shout from Tegras, circling above, drew him from his reverie.
What in Sigmar's name is that?
He said, staring at the edifice that rose from the mist before them.
That, I believe, is the gate to despair, Morbus said.
Aetius had seen similar structures, or the ruins thereof, before. Walled harbours were common on the coast of the Verdant Bay. Most had been destroyed by the plague fleets of the Rotbringers. Others had been twisted to new purpose and made into a pale copy of the swollen bastion now coming into view. The harbour gateway was constructed from haphazardly piled stones and immense moss-covered logs lashed together with rusty chains and thick vines. A decaying stockade of stone and wood extended to either side, vanishing into the thick mists which rose from the roiling waters. The gateway portcullis was open, and galleys slid beneath it into the harbour beyond.
"Should we douse these lights?" Solas asked.
Bells rang from somewhere beyond the palisade. Morbus shook his head.
"It was too late for that the moment we entered this realm. Our coming was heard all the way to Nurgle's manse."
Aetius could hear voices raised in dolorous chanting and the thump of drums. Reeking water vapour drifted down from the titanic waterfalls, staining everything with a vile, ashen patina. And the grinding of the tears, always the grinding. Garders turned to look down at them from the foredeck.
Aetius, move your liberators to the rails. Solas, form up your judicators midships. Pharos, to your warriors will fall the oars, I'm afraid.
He gestured to Tegras.
Tegras, you and your warriors will accompany Enyo. Scout ahead and see if you can find the Lord Castellant. Do not engage the enemy unless you must. Taunus, Cadoc, remain here. We may need your speed in the hours to come.
Cadoc, for once, offered no argument. Aetius wondered if the oppressiveness of this place was beginning to affect even the unruly knight Azeros. As the others moved to follow their orders, Aetius looked out over the rail at what awaited them beyond the stockade. Through the noxious mist, he could see the outline of what might have been a town, or towns. As the galley passed through the gateway, he realized that the rickety structures were not all in one place, but instead encrusted the cancerous hummocks of spongy-looking fungus dotting the surface of the water. A roaring sound rose from somewhere beyond them, and the current grew stronger. Soon, the order to lay on oars was given. Aetius glimpsed galleys drifting in the pall, and other things besides, as he ordered his liberators into position. He saw great, undulating shapes that moved noiselessly through the water and between the half-submerged wrecks littering their path. Ghostly orbs of colourless light floated across the water's surface, drawing near, only to then dash away. One of his warriors pointed towards a galley that had been cracked in two.
Look!
She said. The wreck was covered in thick moss and large clumps of fungus. Makeshift tents had been erected on the drier stretches of its hull, and pale shapes huddled about flickering bale fires. At the sight of the cobalt-limbed galley, the inhabitants of the wreck fled into its overgrown hold.
"Can we not aid them?" a liberator asked.
"I do not think they would welcome us," Aetius said. "Stay alert. There are more than demons and lost souls in these waters."
Far above, something shrieked. Carrion birds, or something worse, circling overhead.
Aetius hoped it wasn't an omen. Tegris of the Sainted Eye glided through the noisome air, searching the murky waters below for a telltale flash of silver. The Lord Castellan was close by. Tegris could smell the tang of lightning on the air, clear and sharp, despite the obfuscating stench of this place. He banked, swooping low around the garret of a shaggy house, leaning haphazardly over the water. Faces peered at him from within, eyes wide with fear. What little he'd glimpsed of their features before they scrambled out of sight set his stomach to turning. Even worse was the omnipresent grinding that haunted the air. It was the slow turning of the garden's levels on an unseen axis. The air shuddered with it. Much of the miasma that clung to everything was spewed out from between the rims of the levels as they ground against one another. He could just make out the flatulent spurts of pollution in the distance, spreading over everything. There was foulness wherever he looked. It was in the air and the water, and in the faces of every inhabitant of this twisted realm. He saw shuffling, hunched figures fishing off crooked jetties, or wandering aimlessly along the shores of the islands. Their flesh shone with an unhealthy radiance, and their movements were stiff and full of pain. What were they? Captives? Slaves? Or had they always been here, sprouting like mushrooms in the dark? Was this what awaited the inhabitants of Gairan if the storm casts failed? Sympathy warred with revulsion. It was his duty, as one of the faithful, to help those who could not help themselves. But did that extend to people such as this? Were these lost souls worthy of help? He banished the thoughts and tried to focus on the task before him, letting the heat of his crackling feathers burn him a path through the falling rain. Once such a hunt would have come easily to him, but in the months since his reforging, he'd come to realize that his mind was not as sharp as it had been. It was as if part of him had been erased. His eyes were as keen as ever, but the old instincts had been blunted somehow and replaced with something else, something he could not articulate. It was as if there was some strange song just at the edge of his hearing. It taunted and teased him, drawing his mind from his duties to the contemplation of the winds, the sound of the trees, the murmur of the storm-blown grasses, things he'd never noticed before. Tegris could not help but wonder if it had something to do with the circumstances of his death. Had something been planted within him by Alariel? She had grown Lord Castellan Grimm a new hand. Had she done something similar to him? Whatever it was, he could not feel it here, and that absence was almost as distracting. He shook his head and checked his warriors' positions. His prosecutors were spread out to either side of him, flying in a dispersed formation. Ennio, as ever, ranged far ahead. The Night Venator swooped low through the mists, her wings cutting the water and causing jets of steam to billow upwards. Tegris watched her for a moment, and then let his attention drift. He banked again, cutting left. Below him, he saw what he took to be walled gardens of filth, containing quivering rows of blighted vegetation, or skull-shaped blossoms which screamed shrilly as his shadow fell over them. Hunched shapes tended to the shrieking flowers and stared upwards in dull-eyed curiosity as the prosecutors passed overhead.
"What is this foulness?"
one of Tegris's huntsmen growled, swooping close to him.
"Everywhere we look, they till the soil, as if anything of worth could grow here." "A death's head garden," Tegris said. "I saw its like when we burnt the Rotfane. They are farmers, tending to a blighted crop." "We should destroy these hovels," the prosecutor said. His voice was strained with emotion.
Tegris glanced at him. All of them were feeling stretched thin. The air here was almost poison, and the omnipresent stench ate away at their composure like acid.
"And like mushrooms, they would sprout anew in a few days."
Tegris bent his head. Something had caught his eye.
"No, such destruction would serve no purpose, save to alert the enemy and waste what little time we have." "I think they're already aware of us," the warrior muttered.
The dull tones of a funerary bell began to sound from a crooked bell tower. The tower's pointed roof was decorated with a plethora of fish carcasses nailed to the mossy slates, and something bloated and giggling dangled from the weathercock. More bells sounded, in response to the first, until all the air was trembling with the vibration of them. Tegris flinched back as an arrow cut past him to embed itself in a nearby rooftop. He turned and saw Enyo hurtling towards them as swiftly as her wings could carry her. She'd loosed the shaft to catch his attention. She signalled urgently, and he followed her gestures. Down below, dark shapes nosed through the narrow, winding canals between islands. Though they were shrouded by the mists, he nonetheless recognised the shapes of galleys. A dozen or more, converging swiftly on the blue glow of the stormcast commandeered vessel. The thump of drums echoed up, and the watery glow of balefire illuminated the decks, revealing the demonic shapes which crowded them. How had they got so close without him noticing? Was there some enchantment at work, or had he simply been inattentive?
"Spread out," he said, even as he cursed his carelessness. "Strike swiftly. Aim for the rudders and the masts, and retreat after."
Without waiting for a reply, he swooped around a ruined turret, scattering a flock of scaly pigeons, and dived down through the rain towards the closest galley. There was no time to send warning. All they could do was hope to delay the enemy and alert the others with the crash of battle. As his hammers shimmered into his waiting hands, Tegris prayed that it would be enough.
"You can feel it, can't you, Torglug?"
Gatrog said. The Rotbringer stood at the farthest extension of his chains, so close Tornus could smell the stink of his armour.
"How familiar this all is." "Torglug is never coming here,"
Tornus said. His eyes remained fixed on the islands, with their tottering towers and slumping rooftops. Strange birds, their feathers waxy with rot, watched the passing galley with flat eyes. Their cries sounded like laughter. Every mould-drenched wall and square of sloughing thatch seemed to twist itself into a leering, jovial face. His hands tightened around his bow.
"I find that hard to believe. The woodsman was most devout."
Gatrog shuffled closer so that he stood beside Tornus.
"It is sad to see faith twisted so."
Tornus looked at him.
"Yes."
He wished he were anywhere else, even in the air, with Tegris and the others. Instead, Gardas had tasked him with guarding their prisoner. Gatrog smiled and nodded, acknowledging the point.
"It is even as Blightmaster Gahul said in his 32nd missive to the Oakdwell King. Faith, like a river, must occasionally find its course altered for the good of the land."
"The Oakdwell King is being dead," Tornus said.
He knew this because Torglug had been the one to kill the ancient creature in his robes of leaf and vine. He could still hear the snap of an antler as it broke off in his fist. Still feel the warm gush of sap as it coursed over his hand, and the Oakdwell King gasped his last.
"And his people serve the King of all Flies to this day,"
Gatrog said solemnly. He peered at Tornus.
"They live because they chose a new course."
Tornus said nothing. Gatrog leaned close.
"The King of Flies offers life, my friend. Freedom from doubt and pain. Freedom from those raw, red things that taint even the smallest of moments. To know, to understand, and give oneself over to him is to know with unalterable certainty that you are loved."
"His love is being a lie."
Gatrog looked away.
"No. The lie is that there is any hope at all. That there is something better awaiting you in the dark and the quiet."
He shook his head.
Hope is the chain that drags you in the wake of the universal wheel. Free yourself of it, Torglug.
I am not being Torglug, Tornus said.
But even as he spoke, he heard a rasping, glottal whisper of rebuttal.
You are. You are.
Asphinis stirred on his shoulder, talons tightening their grip. He wondered if the Star Eagle could hear what he heard.
You are, for I see the seed of holy despair in you.
Gatrog thrust a grimy finger into Tornus's chest.
Like a corpse blossom buried under ash, awaiting the rain to draw it to the surface once more. Torglug you were and are.
Tornus caught Gatrog's finger and twisted it back. It popped free with a squeal of metal and a crack of bone. He stared at it in disgust and flung it at the Rotbringer. Gatrog scrabbled to retrieve it, cursing.
I am not being him any more. Torglug is being dead, and only Tornus is remaining.
That which is not dead can forever lie, until even death himself dies,
Gatrog said, as he tried to reattach his finger.
Those touched by Nurgle cannot die. When the old sun goes cold and dark, we will sink beneath the ground to await the touch of the new in millennia to come. Not even the cursed light of Azir can sear the realms clean.
Tornus caught Gatrog by the throat and shoved him back against the mast.
That is being a lie. I am being cleansed, as you are being soon.
Gatrog's eyes widened.
What?
There is being a seed in me, you are saying. Well, there is being one in you as well. I am seeing it earlier. It is being the seed of humanity. It is being the flicker of order amidst the chaos.
Tornus spoke softly, intently.
Your rules, your honor. Is it being play-acting or something real?
How dare you question my honor,
Gatrog growled.
If I but had a blade, I would silence you.
His hands clenched uselessly, and he sagged.
But I do not. So we must fence with words instead.
He glared at Tornus.
You were a hero once. What happened?
I am seeing the light, Tornus said.
He stepped back.
As you will be seeing it.
Never! Better death than such a dishonor.
He stopped as a glittering blade came to rest against his throat. Cadoc Kell studied the Rotbringer.
Easily done. But say the word, and I shall feed you to whatever passes for fish in these waters.
Cadoc looked at Tornus.
Why do you insist on talking to this thing?
Every deed is having a seed which is remaining, Tornus said.
He used his bow to pull the star blade from Gatrog's throat.
I am learning such at the life wells.
These would be the same life wells you destroyed.
Cadoc sheathed his blade with a flourish.
Yes, I can see that you must have learned much from them.
Tornus flinched.
That was not being me.
Oh, but it was.
Cadoc gestured to Gatrog.
On this one point, I agree with this creature. It was you.
He leaned close.
You lost your faith, and your people suffered. You have found it again, but how do we know that you will not lose it once more? I am being redeemed,
Tornus said. His words sounded weak, even to him.
There is no redemption, Cadoc said. No forgiveness. There is only faith. You either have it, or you do not.
His hand slipped to the hilt of his sword.
Do you have faith?
Tornus's fingers curled into a fist. He wanted nothing more than to strike the knight Azeroth, to pummel him into silence. Instead, he forced himself to relax.
My faith is not being yours to judge.
He glanced at Gatrog.
Or his.
That remains to be seen, Kadok said.
He clapped a hand on Tornus's shoulder, then strode away. Tornus watched him go. Was this a test, then? Was Sigmar judging his worthiness even now? Osphinus chirruped and flapped his wings. Tornus turned, scanning the waters. They gleamed greenly in the pale light of Argus, the plague moon. Something was moving out there. He heard the thud of drums and the slap of oars. Swiftly he drew an arrow and loosed it into the mist. A scream pierced the air as the arrow struck home. Lightning flashed in the distance, revealing the outline of something drawing close. He heard the crash of thunder and recognized the sound of a prosecutor's hammer. A moment later, the black prow of a galley pierced the murk and surged towards them.
To arms! Tornus called. To arms!
Wake up, Sir Knight.
Grim stirred in his chains. Blearily, he shook his head, trying to clear it. Had he fallen asleep? A hand, small and smelling of strange unguents, stroked the cheek of his war mask. He jerked back, alert now. Flies crawled across his helmet and chest plate. The woman who stood before him was beautiful and repugnant in equal measure. She was dressed as a noblewoman of the Jade Kingdoms, in a rotting gown, and her face was covered by a filth-encrusted veil. He was thankful for that, as he had no desire to see the face beneath. Her hair hung in a lank coil down her back, and trailed after her like a serpent's tail. A corroded chalice, dotted with maggots and boils in place of gemstones, hung from a corded belt about her narrow waist.
Who?
He began. He trailed off as the smell of her hit him. She stank of damp rock and sour water, of mossy coolness and wet shadows. But beneath that was a more fetid odor, one that was hot and scalding. She reached up with pale fingers, wet with what might have been blood, and traced them across his chest.
7 days from never, we dance always and do not fall,
she said, drawing shapes on his chest plate.
History dreams of us, my knight. We are its shadow and soil, all in one. We carry his blessings on our skin wherever we go. We shimmer with a light of black stars, so that those who know the way might dance in our wake.
She leaned close, and he could see things squirming beneath her veil.
The burning in your blood will set you free.
Grim closed his eyes.
You are not here. You are some evil dream.
He felt warm, wet breath wash across his face.
I am a dream, she said. Your dream. Will you, won't you, dance with me?
Begone, witch!
Grim snarled, twisting his head aside. A sound like dead leaves dancing across stones greeted his words. He opened his eyes and saw that she was gone. She had never been there in the first place.
She was beautiful. Was she not?
Buboniccus's voice tore through him like a spasm. Grim's hands curled into fists, and he relished the sensation, painful as it was. He preferred pain to numbness.
She was not, he said.
You have no eye for beauty, then. She is life itself, that sweet lady. Queens are as the dust beneath her gentle hooves, and goddesses even less. You should feel honored, Loras. Do not speak my name. I shall. Soon it, like all that you are, will be mine.
Grim shook his head.
Who was she, then?
Do you not recognize the Lady of Cankerwall when she graces you with her presence? For shame. It is no wonder you did not bow.
I am chained up.
That as well.
Laughter burbled up inside Grimm, threatening to burst through his lips. It was not his laughter. Grimm felt sick. He wanted nothing more than to cut himself open and drag out the cancer he felt festering in his gut. Tear it out in red, wet gobbets and fling it into a cleansing fire.
And you would die in the doing so.
Better death than whatever it is you intend, Grimm said.
Then you'd best be quick about it.
Heavy steps thumped on the stair. Spume ducked beneath the entrance, followed by a group of stunted figures. The creatures wore filthy robes over their malformed bodies and carried a large cauldron on their shoulders. They moaned a soft, sad song as they went about their labours. Boiling liquid sloshed over the rim as they set the cauldron down, and Grimm gagged at the smell.
Still breathing, then? Good!
Spume scratched himself, dislodging fat, black lice from beneath his armour.
I'd hate for you to miss this.
Where are we?
The Port of Despair,
a thin, hissing voice answered. A hunched feminine shape stepped out from behind Spume and shuffled towards him.
Is this the one?
Do you see any other shiny skins, Urslaug?
Spume drawled, dismissing the slaves. They trooped back above decks, still moaning their sad song. The woman peered up at Grimm, her eyes hidden beneath a filthy blindfold. She might once have been beautiful, but centuries of neglect had left her a ruin of a woman. Her body was frail and bent, her hair lank and tangled. The faded remnants of tattoos marked her grimy skin, and Grimm wondered who she had been.
A witch,
she said, as if reading his thoughts. She reached out as if to touch him, and then drew back.
There's a storm in this one. Lightning in his veins and thunder in his bones.
Yes, and silver on his fingers. Can you divine his secrets?
Spume sounded testy.
Or should I take you back to your garden and leave you to tend your death's heads in peace?
If I thought you would, I might say the latter.
Urslaug cocked her head and whistled. Tiny, bloated shapes bounded and bounced down the steps into the hold, giggling and shrieking. Grimm felt his stomach churn as the nurglings spilled and slid across the deck. They clambered up Urslaug's robes and clawed pitifully at Spume's shins. He kicked them aside, eliciting screams of laughter. Urslaug gathered several into her arms and stroked their bulbous heads. She turned towards Grimm.
It's a very nice garden, I assure you.
They all tend gardens here, grubbers and growers,
Spume chuckled.
They refuse to give in, you see,
he said. He tapped the side of his head.
Stubborn, like you. So here they stay, too afraid to travel deeper or attempt escape, too foolish to resign themselves as they ought. So they sit and grow moss in their gardens and on themselves.
We are necessary to Grandfather's great plan,
the witch said.
Even as much as yourself, Reaver.
What use a farmer when you can simply take the crops of another?
Spume's tentacles yanked gently on one of her wormy braids.
I am the fire that makes the soil black and fertile. A true servant of Nurgle and life itself, just as you once were.
And who tends the soil when the fire burns itself out?
Spume shrugged.
The Lord of all things provides.
Urslaug shook her head.
And that is why they say you are a fool, Gutrot Spume. Even the woodsman in his madness recognized the purpose behind his actions. But you might as well serve the blood god.
Spume grunted, and his grip on her hair tightened, eliciting a pained hiss.
Careful what you say to me, Urslaug. My patience runs thin these days.
A fat spark of balefire leapt between them. Spume released her and stepped back, swatting at the flames that smouldered on his chest.
As does mine, Urslaug said. I grew tired of your bullying long ago, Spume. Then you'd best be about your task, eh?
Spume wriggled a tentacle towards Grimm.
Many have tried to divine the secrets of these half-souls, Urslaug said,
as she selected a squealing nurgling and gave it a gentle squeeze. The tiny demon giggled in pleasure.
They all failed.
It gave a squeak of pure delight as she tossed it into the cauldron.
What makes you think that I'll be any more successful in my own attempt?
I have confidence in the quality of your cunning, witch,
Spume said, running a callous tendril over the blade of his axe.
The knowledge you seek would earn the pair of us much esteem in the eyes of the Lord of all things.
And you'd willingly share such plunder, would you?
I pay my debts, Spume said.
Urslaug laughed until she coughed.
You lie as well as you sing, Lord of Tentacles.
Spume thumped the deck with the haft of his axe.
And your laughter is as shrill as ever. I can have you thrown overboard if that is more to your liking.
Peace,
the witch murmured. She raised her blindfold and glanced at Grimm with a single, pus-laden orb. The eye was not that of a human, or even an animal. Instead, it was a dollop of demonic putrescence, smoothed and shaped into a semblance of an eye. It glistened evilly in the light of the balefire lanterns, swimming with obscene shapes. Grimm turned away from its gaze, sickened to his core.
Two souls,
she said, lowering her blindfold.
There are two souls in that body.
Spume nodded.
So I suspected.
He raised his axe.
I'll be cutting the one out and salvaging the other. Only I need to know which is which.
Hard to say. Hard to say.
Urslaug wheezed, stirring her cauldron with a finger.
One thing I do know is you'll have to fight to keep either. Hark at that.
She cupped an ear. Grimm stiffened. He'd heard it as well. The whisper crack of whirling hammers. The growl of lightning unleashed.
No,
he said, unable to believe his ears.
What are you babbling about? I... By the wormy bones of Bolothrax!
Spume stumbled as something shook the ship down to its barnacles. The prisoners in the bilge cage screamed and groaned as the hull sprouted numerous leaks. Urslaug chuckled and tossed another nurgling in the cauldron. She hadn't stumbled at all when the ship shook.
It'll take me some time to brew what I need. You'd best go and see to whatever that is.
As Spume thudded back above decks, cursing with every step, Urslaug turned to Grimm. A chill ran through him as she gave a tombstone smile.
Now, we have much to discuss, you and I.